You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Hey everyone, today's Real Vision Daily Briefing is sponsored by Engrave, maker of the coldest hardware wallet, Zero, and stainless steel backup, Graphene. Engrave brings you the highest security in a touchscreen experience to safely manage all your crypto offline. Enjoy a 10% Real Vision discount in engrave.io shop with the code REALVISION. Now to the top analysis of today's markets. David, welcome to My Life in Four Trades.
Looking forward to the next hour, Maggie.
It's fun to have you in person. We do a lot of these virtually. So
True. So
the nature of this is we talk about two of your best trades, two of your worst trades. They're not your only good trades and your only bad trades, but they're just two that are kind of important or significant in some way. But before we dive into them, tell me a little bit about yourself. Where'd you grow up? What were you like as a kid?
Oh, okay. Well, I grew up in Ottawa, which is the capital city of Canada. And what was I as a kid? You're going to be shocked when I tell you, but I was shy. I was a real shy kid.
I am going to be shocked by that.
Yeah.
Because we just left an auditorium where you were holding court. You were really shy.
I was a shy kid up until I was probably a young teenager. And I also was a very poor student. I hated school.
That's even more shocking.
I love going to the hockey rink and playing hockey. And I came from a scholastic family. My mother was a kindergarten teacher. My dad had his master's degree in civil engineering. And when he wasn't working for the federal government, he was teaching at the University of Ottawa. I got two older sisters. One's a nurse and a teacher. One's head of education at a high school. And my brother taught at the University of Tel Aviv. He was professor there. So I come from this family of pedagogues, and I was the black sheep of the family. And in fact, I remember when I was in grade 9, I got my final grade was 64%. It was like a C minus. And I remember I was the youngest of four kids, the Rosenbergs, that went to Hillcrest High School. And Mr. Hayes, the homeroom teacher, said to me, "Are you sure you're a Rosenberg?"
What happened to you?
But what happened was that I ended up having an English teacher, taught English and history in grade 10. And I don't know what it was about him. It made me think a lot later in life, even to today, the importance of communication. Mm-hmm. Because when I went to school, it was like, remember Charlie Brown's school teacher?
Wah, wah, wah.
That's what it was all to me. But so anyway, this guy, Mr. Haiba, I was so jazzed. I was never jazzed up to go to school. I was at this point 15 years old.
Wow.
But he spoke in a language that I understood, and I got very excited about school. Because if you're not excited about something, if you're not enthused, I was more enthused about hockey.
So it wasn't capacity. It was you were not interested.
I was just not interested in school. And it was a big disappointment to my parents, because education was like, that was number one commandment.
And that can feed, that sense of disappointment can feed on itself then. And then you lose even more interest.
But then it moved in the opposite direction. So the downward spiral started spiraling upwards, and I started getting jazzed up about school.
Of course not.
But
you still had to be.
Especially my hockey buddies.
You had to have a rep.
Whose marks were worse than mine. But but anyway, I was a shy kid. I was a slow learner. Yeah. So I guess, you look at me today and all I can say is that, what you see isn't always what you get.
Yeah. Or how you start out.
Yeah.
Often. So once you re-engaged with school, did you have an interest in finance or economics? Was that something that, it sounds like you came from educators, so it doesn't sound like
right.
It was necessarily the family business.
No, but what's interesting is that I took economics in grade 11. And remember the teacher's name, Mr. Dillabo. So I come home and my dad says to me, "So how was your course in economics?" And this is high school. So I said, yeah, Dad, you know, we learned this Keynesian model where the assumption is that we're a closed economy with no government. My dad looks at me incredulously and says, no government? Come here, son. And he shows me his paycheck. And he says, you see this, 50% of my paycheck? He says, yeah, that goes to the government. He says, maybe you should take something a little more practical. So the next day I dropped economics, only to retake it in university. And there's a story about that too. I took economics in grade 11, took it for one day, and then dropped it, only to then become an economist.
So how did you get back on the track to become an economist?
Okay. So in the name of full disclosure, I actually started at University of Toronto in 1979, and I enrolled in the Bachelor of Commerce department. So I wanted to be an accountant. Don't ask me why, because as I found out later in life that, economists are accountants, but with better personalities. So I'm taking accounting, and it's already December. It's like halfway through the first semester, and I'm doing well in everything except one course. The one course that you'd want to actually do well in if you want to be an accountant, which was financial accounting. So like I'm failing miserably, and I can't, for whatever reason, in the midterms, I can't get the T accounts to balance. No matter how I try, I can't get in the balance. So I go to my professor, and in those days, it was the accountants that worked at the big accounting firms were the lecturers in first year. And I'm doing well, managerial accounting, fine, computer science, fine, calculus, not a problem. But I couldn't balance the books. So I go to Mr. Lee. Gary Lee was his name. How do you like that?
You remember all of them.
I can't remember my last bad forecast, but old professors' names, those I remember really well. So I say, I have a meeting with Mr. Lee, and I say, Mr. Lee, like, what's the matter with me? He says, whatever it is, he says, you've got a mental block. You can't balance your T accounts, Dave. You got a mental block. I said, well, what do you tell your students who can't balance the books? He says, oh, I tell them to go in economics. So that's what I did.
It's not saying a lot for the field of economics, is it?
No, it's actually, that's why when you see, the worst finance ministers or treasury secretaries are people who actually have an economics degree.
Right, we need to get an accountant in there.
Like, tell me, is Janet Yellen balancing the books? I don't think so.
Not these days.
She's an economist. So there you go. We don't do a good job of balancing the books, but we do a very good job at confusing people. That's what I do well.
So how did you make your way into working in finance? Did you, upon graduating, say, I want to head toward banking, did you even know, or was it just that you kind of stumbled into it?
I stumbled into it for the most part. So I graduated with my master's degree from the University of Toronto. So like when I go to the States and I said, I graduated from U of T, they say, oh, I didn't know you went to University of Texas. No, University of Toronto, sorry.
That happens all the time to Canadians, yeah, doesn't it? When they're working in the U.S.
So I actually had my degree in, my specialty was international economics. But I graduated in the early 80s and, there was not a lot of jobs in that field. And actually we're coming out of the horrible recession of the early 80s. But I was a teaching assistant for the housing and real estate economics course. It was a very specialized course. And the professor, thankfully, really liked me, and I was also a teaching assistant for that course when I was doing my graduate work. So he put a good word in for me, and the federal government, this was back in 1984, was starting to expand in a lot of areas, doing a lot of cost-benefit analysis back then. The conservatives, who had been out of power for like 20 years, came into power, and they were doing a deep dive cost-benefit analysis into every liberal government program that there was. So
we're going to get them.
So Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation, which is basically Canada's equivalent to Fannie Mae, developed this thing called Program Evaluation Division, which was really going back and seeing, do we need all these housing programs? And if we do, how do we change them, make them more efficient? Or if we don't, how do we get rid of them? Mm-hmm. So I basically got hired in this, call it this housing cost benefit analysis department for the federal government, because Canada Mortgage and Housing, sort of it's called a crown corporation. It's like an arm of the government. I'm there for 3 years in Ottawa. So I grew up in Ottawa, went to University of Toronto for 5 years, came back to Ottawa. My parents were begging me to come live with them. You know, I'm 23 years old. And come back to the house, Dave. And I said, Mom, Dad, thanks, but I think I'll just live downtown if that's okay. So I went to CMHC, but I found it very stifling. I honest to God, I don't know how my dad managed to be in government for like 30 years. Yeah. And he was at the same job for 30 years. Who does that anymore? But I found after 3 years, the bureaucracy was stifling.
It's very different from the private sector.
And you know what? I could see people that were the slackers of all slackers. Like we're not even talking 9-to-5ers. We're talking 11-to-2ers.
I feel like even if they're not like that, when they get in there, they become like that.
Well, because the union was so strong, the public sector union, you couldn't get rid of these people. And it was just hard to get anything done. Like we would come to decisions on these housing programs and you'd have to go through so many different layers of committee. And so I just found a lot of hard work.
So you're like, I'm out of here. I need a more dynamic.
Well, I actually, going into my third year at Canada Mortgage and Housing, I started putting feelers out on Bay Street, which is the equivalent to Wall Street in Toronto. So I applied to all the banks. Now, back then, there's no internet. You know, you actually had to type dear who was, you know. And so when I had my CV, you know, you didn't email anything, right? And so I applied to the big six banks in Toronto. Well, I guess one was in Montreal at that point. And one bank got back to me. And they came, they interviewed me, and I got the job. But I had applied. I was basically senior policy analyst for the federal government. And they brought me on. This is the Bank of Nova Scotia. So this is 1987. By the way, I started on October 19th, 1987, the day of the crash.
I remember this from us talking. I was just going to bring that up. So it's so interesting that your foray into that was on such a cataclysmic day, you know?
But I have to make this point because they bring me in as an intermediate economist. And I said, hey, but I'm senior. They said, yeah, in Ottawa, you're senior. In Toronto, you're intermediate. Intermediate economist at the Bank of Nova Scotia. And I was making... In Ottawa, I was making $32,000, and the Bank of Nova Scotia was going to bring me on for $28,000. My dad was my mentor. He was my rock. I said to him, reduce title and lower pay into a higher cost city. And my dad said to me, sometimes in life, you've got to take a step back to take two steps forward. So where do you see yourself in 5 or 10 years? Not next year, the year after. I thought about that a lot because where was I going to be if I stayed in Ottawa, right? So I took the pay cut. I mean, who'd do that today? Took the pay cut, took the, you know, the reduction in title. You know, within a few years, I made up for all that.
Yeah.
But that was a first learning lesson. And I wrote about that, about my dad. In life, you sometimes have to take a step backward to take two steps forward. 100% right. It just means you know, eliminating the noise.
Yeah.
Hey, everyone, we're going to take a quick break right now to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
And investing in yourself, you had faith that would pull you forward.
Well, 100%. Although I got to tell you something, I didn't know what I was doing. Like I didn't. I was this. I've been out of school 3 years. Academic economist with housing, coming on being the financial economist.
Do you think it was helpful that you walked in into chaos? Because sometimes people are so crazy that they're not really paying attention.
100%.
Things are disrupted. So you have an ability to sort of no one knows what that means now. So you kind of level the playing field.
100%. And I went into an economics department where my two bosses, the chief economist and the assistant chief economist, were truly like they could tear apart the Fed and the Bank of Canada's balance sheet like it's nobody's business. They were truly knew how to. And what I loved about it was there wasn't just ivory tower economics. They were tied. Everything we did was tied in to the financial markets. So I remember my first day. My first day on the job was the crash.
Which is just crazy, by the way.
I said, well, my boss said to me, Aaron Gamble, he says, did you read Barron's? What's Barron's? He says, never come to the office again without reading Barron's and without reading Ellen Abelson's Up and Down Wall Street. Don't never come in if you don't. Okay. But yeah, that was, but starting at Scotia.
Yeah.
I'm walking around with Warren Jeston. He's the chief economist. Aaron Gamble, he's the assistant chief. And we're going, and I'm the newbie. It's my first day on the job. And I don't know how many pairs of underwear that I brought with me that day, but it wasn't enough. But I'm just standing by on the wall, and we're going to office. We're going the whole Treasury Department, but then we're going all the way up to the CEO, okay? And all the senior, all day long. And I'm following these two guys along, and they had the charts showing that this was a liquidity event. This is not a fundamental event.
They're making their case.
There's no recession coming out of this, and you want to start adding to risk almost immediately. The Fed's going to flood this. It was the right call. Well, I learned the difference between a solvency crisis and an economic crisis and a fundamental crisis and something that's more of a liquidity crisis. And
having the courage to stand by your forecast and conviction, because it could not have been easy delivering that message in that moment of abject fear.
Absolutely right. In any event, they were right. But the senior management at the Bank of Nova Scotia thought there was going to be a recession. And within a month, they sliced the research budget at the bank by half, including economics. So my boss, my direct boss is Aaron Gamble, and he comes to me and he says, hide under your desk today in your office. Don't come out. And I think I did. I think I actually hid under the desk all day long.
Like the George Costanza bed from Seinfeld.
Half the department got fired.
Oh, dear.
Oh, and they were. I just started. I was there basically a month and half. And people who've been there 20, 30 years, and there were tears. And I was in like.
The fact you were paid so little probably saved your job, by the way.
You know, the thing is that at the same time, the person who was mentoring me, the person whose job I took over, Monica Smith, she got a job offer at another bank, at the Royal Bank. Mm-hmm. And she was supposed to tutor me along for the first 6 months. So next thing you know, I'm also doing the morning meetings. I'm having to do stuff that I wasn't supposed to do for at least 6 months. And I was just thrown, you know,
into
the fire. And it's like Aaron said to me, it's going to be time sink or swim for you. Yeah. And your workload's going to go up now that we're. But I remember there used to be this bar called the Louisiana Purchase, just underneath in the underground shopping area. If you've been to Toronto, there's this just incredible miles of like underground shopping
where
malls
hide
and bars.
In the winter.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, it was went to Louisiana and they had a party there and everybody's hugging each other. I just started, right? And it was a goodbye party for like 10 people that got let go. And I said to myself, that is never going to happen to you. If my boss ever fires me, he's going to have to make it feel like he's amputating his right arm. So I made sure. But at the same time, this is all happening and I'm freaking out. I come into like a crash. I come into like this department just got decimated and my mentor, Monica.
Yeah. You got to fake it till you make it now.
And I'm there thinking, wow. And I worked my tail off. Now the thing is that I had a very public sector academic writing style. Wasn't bad. It was just not made for a Wall Street or Bay Street audience. So I'm writing. So I'm doing all my writing that I'm supposed to do. And every time I'm getting it back from one of my two bosses, red X's everywhere, rewritten arrows everywhere. This went on for weeks. My stuff was being rewritten like it was nobody's business. And once again, I am like freaking out. So I said to myself once again, because I talk to myself a lot. And
you said self.
So I actually told my friends, don't bother me for the next three weekends. I'm not going out drinking. I'm not going out partying.
Which is a lot for Canadian hockey players to say.
Well, you know, I was a hockey player wannabe. It was I basically got in my little Honda Accord, drove to the office on early on a Saturday morning. I double parked because I remember I got a ticket, but it was worth it. I went upstairs and I photocopied everything that Aaron Gamble and Warren Justin, the two guys heading there, I photocopied everything they had done for the previous 3 years. I went down with 15 boxes of stuff.
Oh my goodness.
This is the day's photocopy machines. I mean, you know.
You're probably going to rob in the place.
I printed, and for 3 weekends, I sat there in my apartment and I read and I said, I am going to get into their brain. Come hell or high water, I'm going to figure out what makes these two guys tick. You know why? Because I want to keep my job.
Yeah. So it's like studying for Hollywood Park.
I'm reading. And then there's this one day I wrote my usual report and there it is. I went to do some meetings, come back and it's sitting on my desk and there's not a red mark on it. So I'm really confused and I don't know why there's no red mark on it. So I go to Aaron's office. Here's my direct report. He's not there. He went out somewhere, but Warren Justin, the chief economist, is in his office. So I sort of meekly go up and I knock on Warren's door and I go, Warren. He goes, yeah. So I'm at the right by his door and he's sitting at his big oak desk. I said, Warren, I thought I gave this to Aaron for you and Aaron to proof. And it's sitting on my desk and there's no mark on it. And I could see Warren, and we're friends today, although, you know, it's quite a bit of an age difference, but he's trying hard not to smirk. And he says, Dave, you finally get it.
No.
So I went out that night with my friends on a bender to end all benders. You have no clue. And the alarm gets me up. I realize I'm going to be late for the morning meetings. And I run a, you know, take a really quick shower. I think I use soap. Can't remember. And I get dressed and I head downtown on the subway because I got the morning meetings to do. I'm sitting on the subway. I am so hungover. I don't even think I was hungover. I think I was still
drunk.
Yeah. I look down on my shoes and two different shoes. Not just two different shoes, but remember in the 80s? No, I don't think you'd remember. You were like, you know.
I remember.
I don't think, so in any event, one shoe had tassels and one didn't. So you know what I'm saying? This is not going to pass. So in any event, one of the junior economists, more junior to me, I could see, because I got to do the morning meetings.
Give me your shoes.
No, well, nobody was in the office because the morning meetings were early. Yeah. I'm the only one there, but I see. It's like an oasis in the desert. This guy, his name was Marc Poffin. He got a pair of shoes by his desk, but he was like I'm a size like 10. He's a size 9. So I got to fit into his shoes, and I'll send him an apology later. But I put on his shoes, but like my toes are like curling. So I'm there thinking, this is going to be really rough because not only am I really hungover and my eyes are half open, but like I'm squinting because my toes are in pain. So anyway, did the meetings, put the shoes on, got through it. And that was and I've written about this, that day of the no red mark, it was like the day of Mr. Haiba in grade 10.
Yeah.
It's like, it was like.
Open the next door.
Well, it was like an aha moment. But then all of a sudden, you know what happens? Well, this is what it does, right? How you shift from a total lack of self-confidence to then having self-confidence.
Yeah.
And then it just.
Builds on it from
there. It just builds the momentum. So I actually was the first economist on Bay Street to make it to senior economist before 30.
We're going to take another quick break to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Libsyn Ads. Go to libsynads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Amazing but, for a guy who started out. So I'm going to pick up on and we're going to dive into your trades now with a sort of understanding. And it's interesting you said that's never going to happen to me on those layoffs, because your first trade is one of your best. I think these are in chronological order. And that was starting your own newsletter in 1998 when you were at Bank of Montreal. So you obviously moved. You moved your way up. You're confident, doing well. You have a great reputation. So what's happening at this point? You're in Bank of Montreal. What sparked that trade?
Well, so going on the Bank of Montreal was basically, I could see after being at the Bank of Nova Scotia for, 7-8 years that, you know, Aaron and Warren weren't going anywhere. And I was starting to bump up against where Aaron was, but there was no room for me to be promoted to where I wanted to be. So out of the blue, I got called by a headhunter. And from the Bank of Montreal, and I was going to be the number two person in their economics department, which is what I wanted. And it was actually monetarily was going to be a lot more lucrative too. So money talks. And after being at Scotia for 7-8 years, I went to Bank of Montreal, and I'm there for 1998. I guess I was already there 4 years. But there was a new management came in at the Bank of Montreal, and one of the guys who was heading up the whole treasury department was a guy named Bill Down, who ultimately became the CEO of the Bank of Montreal years later. So what happened was that I used to do the morning meetings again, like I did when I was at Scotia. I used to split them with Aaron Gamble, but I did most of them when I was at BMO. And so with the traders and the sales guys, and this guy Bill Down, who is now heading up the whole treasury group, sees me at a client event, and we're at one of the hotels, and he finds me where you usually find me at around 10:30 at these things, which is at the bar.
I was guessing the bar until he said 10:30.
Having a double single malt, and Bill Down comes up to me, and he's a very senior guy. He's probably like the number four guy at that point at the bank. He says, "Dave, I'm meeting to talk to you." He says, I've been watching you at the morning meetings the past little while, and I don't want to take this the wrong way because everybody loves your morning meetings, but you speak really fast." And then becomes a game of broken telephone. "What did Rosie say? What did Rosie say again? What did Rosie say again?" So he says, "I have a great idea for you." He says, "I want you to start your own newsletter every morning. I want you to get your thoughts from these morning meetings down on paper, blast it out." And he says, "In fact, we'll market the you know what out of it, and we'll send it off to clients as well and off to the media." But he says, "First things first," which is to get your thoughts down on paper every single morning. Now, the thing is that I pushed back on that.
Because that's work.
Well, it's not that. It's like, it's a bad reason, but it's something I learned from, which was, what if it fails?
Right. It's not just said. It's like a record of it.
Yeah. Like, what if it flops? What if it's a flop? I don't want to be a flopper. Yeah. So
you had a lot of fear or trepidation.
There was fear, and the fear of failure, which is a lousy excuse not to undertake a new endeavor, because
one so many people will struggle with.
Yeah, well, the most successful people I met had a lot of failures, and those were learning lessons. Mm-hmm. And then you don't really know what success is until you've had those. But I was nervous, but how can I say no? The guy was going to be the future CEO. He was technically my boss's boss.
Telling you to do it.
I said to him, "Well, the thing is that the chief economist at the time, my boss, was Sherry Cooper."
I've interviewed her very often.
Right. Well, she was a big name.
Yeah.
Big name back then on Bay Street. And I said, "I don't think that Sherry's going to go for this." He says, "Well, you leave Sherry to me." So I started this newsletter. And at that point, it was called Rosie's Tidbits. And it went viral. The next thing you know, the sales desk is taking me out to see institutional clients. That never happened before. I'm in the Globe and Mail. I'm in the National Post. I'm getting TV interviews. And it created, shall we say, some tension with Sherry and myself, okay? Because what happened was that because of the notoriety, the Brendan Woods survey, which is like the investor's intelligence on Wall Street, so I outranked Sherry in my last year there in 1999. So, like I said, it created quite a bit of friction. The one thing you never want to do is outrank your boss.
No, that's a problem.
But the thing is that, and I could sort of see, like I said to Bill Down, Sherry's not going to go for it. You leave Sherry to me, he says. But the thing is, it took off.
Yeah.
And I'm doing all these institutional meetings and getting presence in the media because let's face it, you know, if you're in the media.
Did it go to your head?
No, never did.
No.
No, never did.
Media attention like that, especially quickly, can be a beast.
It never, even those years at Merrill, and it's only because I got to say, Maggie, the biggest up trade, not the biggest, one of the biggest up trades that I had in my life, I didn't even have a choice, and it was my parents. Mm. So I sort of feel badly, I think, for kids today, maybe even my own kids, although I grew up with it. I'm talking about being raised by Depression era parents with such a strong value system. Mm. I had that. There was never a chance I was ever going to let anything get to my head. But all the notoriety, I remember this was before I even went to Merrill. Okay. I was well known in Canada, but people in the States didn't know who I was. But even then, even I started getting ranked in the surveys, I couldn't believe it.
I think it's interesting because you can, with that background, it's possible to have great confidence without the ego mania that comes with it. Sometimes people aren't able to separate it, but if you have a good value and good grounding, you can get the confidence from success, but without buying into the, you know, drinking your own Kool-Aid, basically, which is probably really, really important.
I think that humility is something that you have to ingrain in somebody. And my parents ingrained it in me my entire life.
Yeah.
And all my siblings too.
I'll agree with you that it's a scarce resource these days.
Yeah. And, it doesn't mean that, you have this big personality on TV and he's got this sharp elbows and he's this big bad bear. But 100%, humility was something that I was taught at a young age.
So what do you think you learned from starting that newsletter? What did you learn from that trade, that positive trade?
Well, it was just basically symbolized what I love to do, what my passion is. And I have this guy who's my boss's boss's boss telling me, I want you to do this. Now, I was, what I learned is that, don't fear failure. It's extra work, 100%. It is extra work. Doing that daily is like an extra job. But
if you like it, it doesn't feel like
work. It's not just like, it's basically, a musician picking up the trumpet, or just going on and sitting down playing the piano. It's like that to me. I realized, and again, it comes down to when you start getting self-confidence and, how that just builds on itself. Mm-hmm. But I realized it was more than just the accolades and the attention, but I realized this daily note is making a lot of difference.
Yeah, it's a creative process that's having positive impact, right?
But, I just absolutely, I love doing it. And I don't even consider it to be work.
It's an extension of yourself.
That's exactly 100%. That's exactly how I look at it. So it gave me an opportunity to do mandated on a daily basis. What does I love to do? What do I love to do? I love to research. I love to write. I love to analyze data and tie it all into the markets and sort of think outside the box. So it gave me that opportunity to do it every single day. And the beautiful thing about doing something like this every single day, you know, if I get it wrong on Monday, all right, Tuesday's around the corner.
That's the other lesson of failure, which is funny for somebody who had to go and photocopy 15 boxes to figure out your writing voice. So your second trade is one of your worst. So I think we're going to fast forward to you left Canada and joined Merrill Lynch. And you'll tell us a little bit about that. But this is an interesting, this is real estate. This is not exercising the option to buy the condo that Merrill rented for you in 2002. So sort of set the scene for us. Are you in New York?
Yeah. It's interesting that, so my wife and kids, I have three young boys, 3, 6, and 9. And out of the blue, I get this call. Well, I've got to say that I get this call from Bob McCann, who's one of the top guys at Merrill, and this is back in August, and I get a call, and he says to me, and I'm in Toronto, I'm at that point the chief economist and strategist for Merrill Lynch Canada, so I'm like Merrill's ambassador in Canada, and he calls
me. Which is a great gig.
Yeah, absolutely, and he calls me up, and he says, would you ever consider moving to New York? This is in August of 2002. I said, well, for which job? He says, never mind which job. Would you ever consider moving to New York? I said, sure. He says, that's all I want to hear. So this is like Thanksgiving week. This is in November. And what happened was that, and this is when, remember, Stan O'Neill came in, replaced Dave Komansky, and they did, once again, a just bloodletting of research. The research budget gets cut again in the wake of the tech wreck. And all the senior leaders on every single research team gets
clean sweep,
including my predecessor, Bruce Steinberg. So, and the email goes out from HR that all these people are getting axed. And Bruce Steinberg's the first one because he was by far the biggest name. So the email just goes out. I'm at my desk in Toronto, okay? And I, by the way, I've got a lunch. I got a lunch date with my parents who are in town. And this is about 11:45. And as soon as I'm looking at the email, my phone starts to ring. And it's a New York number. And I'm looking at the screen. I'm looking at the phone.
Did you think you were getting fired?
And it's Bob McCann.
Did you think you were getting fired?
No.
Oh.
It just happened so quickly.
You're processing.
Bob McCann says, do you remember the conversation we had in August? And I go, you meant that job? That's the job you meant? So anyway, well, of course, they had to do their due diligence, and they brought me in. I was for it to be, quotes, interviewed, but they were watching me. So here's the thing. I didn't find this out for a couple of years. Patrick Brady, who headed up the equity sales and trading desk in New York, told me this, that months earlier, before I got that call in August from Bob McCann, he's walking down the equity sales and trading desk in New York, and so at that point, it was called Morning Market Memo, because I love alliteration. So it wasn't Rosie's Tidbits anymore. Couldn't call it that at Merrill. He says, what? It says Canada? You're reading a Canada guy? So Patrick Brady says, well, this guy writes about everything. So yeah, he's a must read for us. So that was when I got on his radar. So the bottom line is that my wife and kids, I didn't get into my parents, by the way, sort of an hour late. For the lunch, and they're sitting there.
What is happening?
At that point, you know, they didn't have any cell phone. I actually have phoned up the restaurant to say, tell you see these people, they look like this, and tell them that, you know. But when I told them the news about what's happening, that I got this job offer to be chief economist, I'll never forget. They were sitting beside each other. They were just beaming. They were just absolutely beaming.
That's so nice.
But I bought a bottle of champagne.
I was going to say, I hope.
And I came home. But the thing is that, but Rachel was not thrilled, okay?
Well, that's a big, it's funny because you didn't tell them, oh, I got this job as a job offer, because I imagine there's the flip side of that now. You have a family of kids, uprooting them.
Yeah, we had some medical issues with the oldest guy. At that point, he was like 9 years old, and it was holding him back. He just became a doctor, by the way. But there was some audio processing, and he was going to see a specialist. And Rachel did not want to break up his equilibrium,
yeah.
Right? So, and was didn't didn't want to go find another specialist for him. It took us long enough to find somebody mm-hmm. who could work him through his issues, which they did. So I said, well, if you're not coming down to New York, I'm just going to stay in Toronto. So I told McCann, my wife and kids aren't coming down. But he thought I was holding out for more money. So he ponied up more money. Then he flies in a couple of the head honchos from North America. And they say to me, look, they say, we know that your wife and kids are moving down. Here's what we're going to do for you. We'll fly you back to Toronto whenever you want on our dime. And we're going to give you free a one-bedroom condo down in Battery Park City on South End Avenue. So Rachel said, well, look, they obviously want you to take the job. So you got to take the job. And, you know, because you're going to be marginalized if you're here and you'll be a laughing stock. So it's either basically find another job on Bay Street or take that job. But we're not, you know, they're going to pay you to come back. Rachel did say, give it 2 years. In 2 years, come back and monetize your Wall Street experience on Bay Street. So I came back 7 years later. So she says, what happened to 2 years versus 7? I said, I told you, Rachel, I was never good at math. Okay? So anyway, what happens is that I got this condo, but I had an option to buy it. And at that point, Battery Park City, we just had 9/11. Yeah. Everybody cleared out. Asbestos everywhere. Oh, my God.
Crazy.
Yeah. So I could have bought this thing for like
$400,000. Oh, my goodness.
It's like $2 million today. So I had an option to buy. A five-bagger.
The lesson is real estate in New York City, never say no.
Plus, I'd have a pied-à-terre instead of shelling out for a hotel in Midtown.
Exactly,
every time I go
which your adult children would love now. So that's so fun, but it's fun to hear the backstory about Merrill Lynch. So your third trade is one of your worst, and this is interesting. This is neglecting my economics team when I was at Merrill. So what do you mean by that?
What I mean by that... And this comes down to how you want to define leadership. Mm. So I knew that, I was what you would say on Wall Street is a managing producer. Okay. I had an economics team that I'm managing, but I'm producing and otherwise trying to generate revenue for the firm. Mm. And a lot of that also means getting ranked in II.
Mm.
Getting ranked in II, top three, all-star, brings in a ton of investment banking revenue. And plus gives the firm tremendous bragging rights. And so this is, and of course, the chief economist. I mean, there was me and Rich Bernstein, right, on the strategy side. We were the two macro voices. So to get ranked means you have to get out there. I figured out early on, like, why did my predecessor, why did he face the knife? A lot of it, as I found out ex post, was because he was not exactly the friendliest person to the sales force. Mm. You want to get ranked on Wall Street as an analyst or strategist or economist, you have to be there for the sales force. And the sales force is global because most of the time, the portfolio managers, CIOs that vote for you in II, in Investors Intelligence, right? Mm-hmm. That's an oxymoron. they will actually give to the salespeople, here's my votes for Merrill Research, you allocate who you want to do it to. So I realized that the most important thing is availability, just being available. And so I was available 24/7 to the global sales force. So to be friendly, to be accessible, to be dependable, not to hide behind your bad calls, but confront them and just be nice to the clients, answer their questions. But that takes a lot of time.
That's an understatement. Yeah. In the investment banking world, being available to a global sales force at Merrill and their clients is an extraordinary burden.
It was like the derivative desk and the FX desk and the fixed income desk.
It's a lot.
The commodity desk and the equity desk. So and you had to travel. So I was traveling. It was just as well that back in Toronto. I was living out of a suitcase and out of my unit in Battery Park City. I was traveling all the time.
There are going to be a lot of investment bankers or ex-investment bankers listening to this nodding their head. They know that life.
And it was tiring, but a lot of it was fun, right? And they all knew that the wife and kids were in Toronto.
Well, that's it. You didn't have that
I got marketed. But the thing is that I've been to every great restaurant.
Did you gain 1,000 pounds?
Probably even more. It was incredible. I remember the first time. I think I was at it was either Il Molino or Sbobbo. Okay, and I think it was the equity desk rents out the cellar in the basement. And they say, so they have a wine expert. They got like Barolos, Brunellos, Sangiovese, Big Tuscan.
This is when you could do that, by the way. We can't do any of this stuff anymore in investment banking. Yeah. All the rules changed.
Yeah, so anyway, and they had the cheese. So they had a sommelier and they had a cheese expert. Different grades of Parmesan
cheese. So good.
They say, Rosenberg, they say, so here's the deal. You speak for maybe 15 minutes, no acronyms, no GDP, no ISM, keep it high level, keep it funny, keep it erudite. So, okay, I do my gig. There's like 8 of us, you know, in the cellar, and I'm finished. And then they have the Italian, talking about, the 1994.
Vintage TIG, from, yeah. Yeah,
the TIG that we're drinking. I'm swirling my Brunello going, this is shit. The best. And they pay us for this. They pay me for this too. This is rather incredible. But the thing is that when I figured out, after my second year, I got ranked as a runner up, which is fourth in II. Mm. And I figured, oh my God, I'm going to get there. And so by my third year, I was starting to get ranked. And there's nothing else that mattered. So, but it meant I was never around for my team because I'm traveling. Like a vote from a portfolio manager in Seattle or San Francisco or Atlanta is as important as anyone from Manhattan. So I'm all over the place. Don't forget, back then it was like mezzanine CDOs leveraged over 10 times. It was like, I felt like Henry Hill and the Goodfellas, you know, but I was out all the time. And of course I'd go back to my hotel room and I would do the daily. Right, and I would find different times. I'd be in the black car, and I would on my BlackBerry, and I'd be banging the stuff out to my team. But I never had time for my team. Never had time for my team, and I could tell it was a source of frustration for them. And what's interesting is that every year when I got paid my bonus from the head of research, it was a gold star every year. There was not one year where they did not blow me away in terms of compensation and accolades and blah, 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 blah. And, but every year when I got my sort of 360 from my team, so every manager got graded by their team, it was anonymous, okay? And you can write in comments. I don't think there was a year, I was in New York for 7 years, okay, with Merrill. Not one year I scored better than like a 3 out of 10 as a manager.
Mm.
And the comments, never here, never around. And so I was accessible to the clients as I was chasing II votes. And I was failing with my own team. So I said to Candace, who's still head of Merrill Research today, I said, my last year, this is back in 09, I said, you never talk about these horrible grades I get from my team. Like this year was like, I think my best year was 4 out of 10.
Mm.
And she says, you keep on doing what you're doing on the production side. I don't care if they give you a 0.
Oh, wow.
Well, and so, but that to this day, like we're talking about it. So.
Because you had been the beneficiary of people who mentored you and looked after you and spent time with you.
I mentored nobody. And it wasn't that I was being narcissistic. It wasn't about
the way the system was set up.
It was neglect. Well,
You wouldn't have been there for seven years if you paid attention to your team, arguably.
But I look at my friend Rich Bernstein, right? And it's Savita took over for him, and he trained Savita. Mm. And she's now been the chief strategist. When I left Merrill in 09, they didn't have someone to step up to the plate. Yeah. Like they end up hiring Ethan Harris from.
Would you have done it over again if you could have? Would you have done it differently?
I would have because, you know, I would have taken a lot of hard thinking about how to make it work. And I think that I didn't give it enough thought.
But could you have gotten those rankings and looked after your team? Was it possible to do both?
Possible, definitely, because other people have done it.
Mm.
I was just talking to somebody here at the conference who brought in Francisco Blanche to head up the commodity. You know, he now is the head commodity person at commodity research at Merrill. So it can be done. Rich Bernstein did it. Mm. But you see, the thing is that I am a I'm a nose to the grindstone, really tenacious son of a you know what. Mm. So and once I saw, like, the thing is that the II vote, I mean, that's like the holy grail. Yeah. And so the thing is that I knew, but I knew how to do it. Like, I knew how to, I mean, don't forget, I was getting ranked with the most horrible view, like Armageddon, you know?
Would you say you were blinded by ambition?
No, it wasn't about blinded by ambition. It wasn't that at all.
Blinded by the desire to achieve results.
Yes. It's basically when the only person you trust is yourself. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot of humility in that statement. However, I knew that I needed the team to be there. We had a lot of maintenance and housekeeping stuff that had to be done. And don't forget, I had to use them when I was on the road, especially. I need data. I need this. I didn't put enough faith and trust in them.
Yeah.
And that was a huge flaw. So, you know, when you asked about some of the down trades, that's something I should have done a lot better. And understanding it, realizing it, owning it, has held me in a lot better stead as I went and started my own business. Because, you know, I was never bad to my staff. I was never mean to them.
You were just neglectful.
I was neglectful. Exactly. Yeah. Right. And maybe that's worse. They really missed me. We never had team meetings. You know, when I needed them, I'd email them or I'd call them. I only, like, if I needed you, you'll hear from me.
Yeah.
And so I was really so
that,
more
that
like,
level of self-reliance. I think a lot of people are going to really listen to this. That level of self-reliance is ultimately can undo you. It seems like such a good idea at the time, but
It created more work for myself,
yeah.
But I was a beast and wasn't living on more than 4 hours sleep.
I think
night.
We all know somebody like this. Some people will recognize themselves in this, but I think we've all worked with or know someone like this.
But my responsibility, but then again, it was all about the dollar. Mm. Like, you know, basically as long as you keep on producing and bringing in the commission revenues.
And you were being told that as well, you know, you're getting positively reinforced for that. So
I wasn't. Yeah. But anyway, it was.
Do you think
really,
investment banking culture has changed? You think it's still like that?
Well, cause I've been out of it for so long. I think that it is changing. I think it is changing from what I'm hearing, from what level? I think at a big institution, it's a tough grind. In my case, it was a matter of I did sacrifice my team at the holy altar of the II vote. And it wasn't just the II vote. It was basically you got graded on commission revenues from accounts. You know, the wealth management team did their own deep dive every single year. The number of report cards that you got in someone in my position, the number of report cards you got externally, internally, was crazy. And so you always measured your success by not just how people thought of you internally and externally, but were they paying for you?
Mm.
And the thing is that you reach a certain point, I did, where I realized, I get it. I know how to, you know, I get it.
You know how to play the game.
Well, it wasn't, I know how to make these people happy. I know how to make the sales force happy. I know how to make the clients happy. I just knew how to do it. Mm-hmm. And I should have basically, considering the amount of time I was there, given more responsibility to my team.
Mm.
I think it would have made me better off.
Managing's hard work. It's hard work.
Well, it depends. Yeah. Well, it
takes more effort.
It takes effort, takes time, and it takes, you got to have trust in your team, and you got to get out of this mentality, which I had. I had this mentality, right or wrong, that I just got to do it myself.
Yeah.
I just got to, I would have done it differently.
Yeah.
I would have done it differently. I would have given them more responsibility, and I would have liked to have been more of a mentor to them. I am happy that a lot of them over time have gotten other really great jobs.
That's good.
So that was that was one of the downdrafts.
So your fourth one is another one of your best, and that is leaving New York to go back to Toronto?
Yeah. Well, look, this is by 2009. I left in 2002, came back in 2009. The little funny quip about, well, I always told you I was bad at math, honey. That only lasted so long. Short shelf life. The kids in particular, you know, three boys. And at that point, so from 3, 6, and 9, you know, they're now, you know, 9, 12, and 16. And it was getting very, very hard on Rachel. And I was gone at that point, long absences, because I was going on mega road trips to Asia and to Europe. And then coming back and being a weekend dad. And sometimes I'd be skipping a weekend.
And you're exhausted as well.
But the boys were starting to get into their high school teenage years and there's no dad.
Mm.
And I still remember my middle guy, Jacob, who now doubles as my COO.
Yes, we've seen him.
it'd be a Sunday night. I'd be putting him to bed and he'd say, Dad, are you going to New York tomorrow morning? And I go, yeah. And there'd be this guttural sigh. I tear up sometimes just when I think back at it. So, but my family life, like it's, you know what? It's like I neglected my team in the chase for the II vote and the chase for success. But I had no balance in my life. I gave my team, that's what I mean. I gave my team, no time. Mm. Oh, but if you're a client, but then again, they're a paying client. But then again, you have this responsibility because I was a manager. But the same with my family. Like I neglected my family. I really did. And I didn't even really notice it so much because my head was in the clouds. Mm. It'd be a Sunday afternoon and we'd be out with friends and they'd be talking to me. And all I'd be thinking about was, I got to change my story for the morning meeting tomorrow.
Oh, geez.
I got to call Bob Chulo when I get home.
So that's you weren't all. Even present. Were you?
I was not present.
So it wasn't blind ambition. Were you addicted to success?
Yeah. And absolutely. Mm. So the reason why that's an uptrade, because most people would say, well, the uptrade had to be moving to New York. Okay, that was an uptrade. But this was actually in some ways a bigger uptrade, and I'll tell you why. Firstly, I forced myself to get a better balance in my life. I forced myself to actually get reacquainted with my family and be a dad in particular.
Did you make this decision or did they make it for you? Were you given an ultimatum?
No, I wasn't an ultimatum, but I woke up and saw the reality. The family life was deteriorating. Like I really did reach a fork in the road, but I could see it. I could see it.
Thank goodness.
That it's not going to last. And so I did the Yogi Berra and got to the fork of the road and I took it. But the thing is that I did not have balance in my life. It was, my life was all about Merrill Lynch.
Mm.
And I couldn't distinguish, and to this day, because I love what I do, my work became an addiction. And it's one of these things where there is such a thing as too much of a good thing. Remember I said before, I love what I do. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you think about life, there's a balance to everything. Like all of nature is about balance.
Mm-hmm.
And for that period, I really did not have any balance whatsoever. And I abandoned my family and I did. And it created a lot of hardship. You know, my team wasn't my family, but I abandoned them too. I was really a lone wolf.
Mm.
They say I was a bear. I was a lone wolf. I come back and my family life turns around dramatically. And it was just great. And I had a lot of job offers. Merrill said, just do this job out of Toronto. You can work out of Toronto. I said, you can't do this job out of Toronto. You got to be in New York. You got to be in New York for this job. I was not going to set myself up for failure.
Okay? Smart of you to resist that.
I was not going to. They offered me a ton more money. But it just didn't sound right. Plus, I know myself. I know I'd be sucked back into the vortex. Mm-hmm. All the travel. Because you got to, I mean, the thing is that's just, you know, it's like Al Pacino in Godfather 3, you know, and they pull me back. I could see that scene. So I had a lot of offers from a lot of the big banks. And then out of the blue, I get this one from Gluskin Sheff, which was the swanky boutique mutual fund. And I thought, you know what? This sounds interesting because it wasn't going to be global travel. You know, most of their clients were Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver, Calgary, manageable. So I was going to be able to not have a job that would not give me the excuse to say, well, I can't see my family. Mm-hmm. Okay. There's going to be the, give me the balance. I wanted that work-life balance. And I was pushing 50 at that point. So you do the math to figure out how old I am. And I figured, you know what? Go on to the buy side. That sounds really interesting to me. Because I've always been a big sell side economist, Scotia Bank, Bank of Montreal, Merrill Lynch. So I thought maybe you can teach this old dog new tricks and see what it's like on the other side. And I got to tell you something, over and beyond reestablishing my family life and having more work-life balance, because it wasn't nearly as crazy as Merrill was. But it was the ability as a economic seer to see firsthand how to formulate and deliver a forecast that's meaningful to a portfolio manager, mm-hmm. and to a CIO. Because, you know, you're at Merrill Lynch, chief economist, you think you got it all figured out. But, you know, you go to these boardrooms, faceless names, nameless faces, one boardroom, next boardroom, next boardroom, then airport, tarmac, airplane. But when you're there and you're sitting out there with the portfolio managers, and look, they ran fixed income money, they ran equity money, they had a long short fund, so they had an internal hedge fund. And I got it. There was another eureka moment, like about what's important is your base case scenario. But then what are all the other scenarios? And we talked about this in my session. But so actually, it was Ira Gluskin, who was one of the founders, at my first investment meeting when I portrayed my forecast back in 2009. He says, okay, Rosenberg, he says, so this is your base case forecast. What happens if you're wrong? Well, no one's ever asked me that before. I'm gonna be wrong. So he says, so that was when he actually said, you don't have a plan B, you don't have a plan. So I came back to the next meeting with scenarios and I attached probabilities. And I found out when I was going to the meetings, the investment meetings from there on in, I didn't even have to change my base case, say on interest rates. I could have had 80% conviction. I didn't change anything else, but I went to 60% conviction. And let's say I switched scenario B to C and C to B and E to D and D to E. So I just changed the distribution curve of outcomes for these people. I didn't even change anything. Hmm. They'd be writing down furiously. So I realized that you're really dealing with probabilistic outcomes and, you know, what is the cost of being wrong benchmarked against the reward of being right across that continuum of all the forecasts. So I realized that how big that was. So it was a great learning experience. And something else too, is that when I was at Merrill, I always met the portfolio managers and the CIOs. Those are the people that voted. What do portfolio managers and CIOs do? They manage money for real people. Mm. I never met the real people.
Yeah.
If they ever had a thing with real people on high net worth, me and Rich Bernstein did these, 1,000 people in the ballroom and the Pierre, and there'd be the two of us pontificating to this massive high net worth people. But you see, the beautiful thing about Gluskin Sheff is I got to meet the people. Now, don't forget, these were well-heeled. I mean, they had a minimum of like $2 or $3 million. And I got to meet entrepreneurs. Most of their clients were entrepreneurs. And that's when we talked before about, and a lot of them, I learned from them. Failure, success, failure. I learned about how they're dealing with their kids and how they're ensuring that their kids don't get their head up in a bubble. So I learned a great deal. And I'll say right now that talking to a lot of them, especially my last couple of years, it gave me a lot of faith and confidence that I could actually start my own business.
Yeah. And it's so, amazing when you when you spend time with them that
the opportunity to meet the and also actually gave me my forecast became all of a sudden like the burden of responsibility when you're 2 or 3 degrees removed and you're in this ivory tower on VZ Avenue and you know and
now you see the impact of
you see the impact of your decisions and there's money on the line.
It's amazing that you were able to have another chapter of learning at that stage in your life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was a, you know, I would say that that's why I put that down there. You know, cause it was about, I mean, obviously family ties. But it was, a real, I learned more. I say I learned more in the say 10, 11 years I was at Gluskin than I did in my previous 20 years combined. And really how to be, I'm not going to say a better economist, but taught me how to communicate in a different way, and tell people form a decision tree. It was more in how you formulate. It wasn't about doing anything differently, except how do you communicate your view, and make it useful. You know, for the people that you're talking to. So it's, you know, when you're sitting out there with portfolio managers every single day for 10 years, it rubs off on you. And I think it made me better at my craft. Absolutely.
Well, I'd certainly say that it's something we've all benefited from. David, this was amazing. Thank you so much for being on My Life in Four Trades.
Well, thanks for inviting me. Appreciate it.
Hey everybody, today's Real Vision Daily Briefing is sponsored by Engrave, maker of the coldest hardware wallet Zero and stainless steel backup graphene. Engrave brings you the highest security in a touchscreen experience to safely manage all your crypto offline. Enjoy a 10% Real Vision discount in engrave.io shop with the code REALVISION.
This podcast is sponsored by Monarch Money. Are you saving to reach your financial goals? Reaching those goals isn't just about getting more money, but by managing what you have. And the best way to manage your money? Monarch Money. Monarch Money is a new kind of finance app that's intuitive, powerful, ad-free, and takes the headaches out of budgeting. Try it free when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. Monarch puts all your accounts, investments, transactions, and finances at your fingertips. With a complete view of your finances, you'll gain insights on your spending and find new ways to save. Plus, Monarch lets you customize your dashboard, collaborate with your partner, set custom budgets and goals, and track your progress toward them. See why Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it, and why the Wall Street Journal named Monarch Money the best budgeting app overall. Get a 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. That's monarchmoney.com/podcast for your free trial. monarchmoney.com/podcast.